The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I would like to talk a bit about compassion. It was one of the themes for yesterday's day-long retreat. And I gave a talk at the end of the day on compassion. And I woke up this morning, or after I woke up, and thought, oh, I didn't finish the talk. I have more to say about the topic. So hopefully what I'll say today stands on its own. It's not just continuing the conversation most of you weren't part of. We had a one-day sitting yesterday. And one of the things I said in this sitting in the course of the day is that there are there's a variety of things that happen when we sit. And one of the important tasks is called arriving, which is arriving in the present moment. Often the mind, our thoughts, our concerns are elsewhere. And it takes a while to settle the mind, to corral the mind, to convince the mind that being here and present is an important thing to do. So it takes a while to arrive, and that's a whole process in itself. But once we've arrived enough to be here, be present, then the next thing, that's the important thing that happens, is we meet ourselves. And there's a meeting. We find out who's here, what's going on. We find out what's going on, you know, what's happening for us. We find out, for example, we're here enough, we've arrived enough to know that we're mostly not here. We're mostly distracted. Or we find out that there's some unresolved issue, unresolved feelings that are bubbling up. Perhaps layers of them that are buried most of the time, but then show themselves. Perhaps there's something very powerful and beautiful about ourselves we see, our capacity to get calm and concentrated. There's beautiful things, there's difficult things, there's a whole range of the human experience that can show up, and we meet here. And it is quite phenomenal to sit upright and be committed to not, in a sense, not moving, in a sense, staying upright and mindful, and allowing our human experience, human, you know, inner world, whatever needs to come up and go through us. Many people don't have that kind of quality time to do that. One of the keys is just being upright, being still. Keep showing up for oneself. In daily life, there might be times when you face yourself, challenges, for example, but then you give in to it. You kind of go and complain to a friend, or you go cry, or you get angry, or get distracted, or you do all kinds of stuff with it. But here, you stay, and you don't do anything about it, but you stay present, stay mindful for it. In daily life also, there's often a lot of sometimes ignoring aspects of ourselves, or we don't give quality time to what's really going on for us. And we sometimes dismiss it. And in meditation, you can't really dismiss anything. You can't ignore it. It's there. But again, you're upright. You're still. And there's this kind of way we stay still, and kind of, I like that expression, still and empty. We stay still and empty in relationship to all the stuff that comes through, is going on. And we do it hour after hour in one day sitting. We do it day in, day out in practice. And we end up facing ourselves and seeing ourselves in many, many different ways who we are and what goes on. It's a powerful practice. It takes sometimes a lot of courage. Sometimes it takes a lot of forgiveness. But somehow or other, we sit and we face each other, face ourselves, and meet ourselves. I like to say that, I like the expression, to meet ourselves. And when we meet ourselves, I like the idea that when there's a meeting, there's a guest and there's a host. And what kind of host are you to yourself? So when you see what's here, see who you are, what the concerns are, what the feelings are, how do you hold that? What's your attitude towards that? How do you relate to it? Do you dismiss it? Do you judge it? Do you have aversion? Do you cling to it? Do you, you know, what, you know, there's a whole array of different kinds of relationships you can have to what you see here. Some of it's not pretty, and some of it is unfortunate. Some of it is beautiful, the way we relate. Some of it is has wisdom and generosity as part of it, and some of it has the opposite. And part of what we do in meditation practice is to meet ourselves and then find out what kind of host are we for what comes up, for what goes on with us. Do we get agitated and upset? Do we get deflated and disappear? Or can we just keep this upright, empty presence, just stay present for it and be present, see it clearly, be very honest about it, and feel it, be present, and can we do that? That's another powerful thing to do. Or can we offer kindness to it? Can we have kind regard? Is there a compassion towards ourselves in this, as we meet ourselves? Are we a generous host? Are we a gracious host? Are we a compassionate host? So the opportunity is when we sit and face ourselves, meet ourselves, is we all start seeing what kind of host we are, how we hold it all, and then it's possible to adjust it. Let go of things that are not useful and maybe find some ones that are useful. One-day sittings or longer retreats are quite significant places for this to happen because of how long a period of time a person is doing this, facing themselves. Not a few people have come to a one-day sitting, not so much retreats perhaps, but certainly one-day sittings, and run away. They come with a great sense of promise and idealism. Great, path of enlightenment. I'm going to sit here, my first one-day sitting, and I'm certainly by 2 o'clock I'll have some great experience and really have a taste of what Buddhism is really about, and some abstract idea. And what happens is they don't encounter Buddhism; they encounter themselves. And it's uncomfortable. Their past catches up to them, the stresses of the day, of the week, and it gets uncomfortable. And then they don't want, there's certain logic to why bother being uncomfortable. I can go to the beach, or go to the park, or go home and watch television. And so people leave. So that's one way of being. But it's quite remarkable if you stay and hang in there. And just stay with the stuff, even when you want to leave, even when it's difficult, and kind of work through and see what goes on with this meeting. So that was kind of one of the things I talked about yesterday. So then, in terms of compassion, what happens when you meet yourself and what you realize is you've made a mistake? You've erred in your life. Maybe you made a big mistake. Uh-oh. What happens then? When I talked about compassion in the afternoon, I talked about different conditions that support the arising of compassion. The condition that I left out that I thought about this morning is one of the things that supports the arising or compassion or the capacity to feel compassion in a good way is if you've made a really good mistake in your life. If you've really blown it. Now, you don't go out now listening to this talk and go out and, intentionally go out and make a mistake so you can do it well. But there's something very significant that happens when you allow yourself to be honest and sit still and really take in the fact that you've made a mistake. So, there's a story it's one of the most popular stories in Southeast Asian Buddhism. The most popular story is the life of the Buddha, which we celebrate next week. The second most popular story, which is not so well known here in the West, I've taught it a few times here, but not so well known, is the story of, in the classic myth, before the Buddha became Buddha, he spent many lifetimes preparing himself to become a Buddha. He was a bodhisattva. He was, doing all this training and stuff. And it's a story of his last lifetime before he became a human being. And when he was born as a prince named Visantara. He had this fault that he demonstrated pretty much as soon as he was born, or as soon as he could growing up. And his fault was that he was overly generous. And now generosity is held to be a great ideal in Buddhism, and one of the great things to prepare a person to become a Buddha is to cultivate a lot of generosity. So, you know, he'd been doing that a lot, probably over many lifetimes. And then his last lifetime, he went overboard. And he was so generous, he started giving away things that weren't his. And so it started to become a problem. And at some point, I think what it was, he gave away, I think, the royal elephants, which didn't belong to the king, but apparently belonged to the whole country. So it wasn't his to give away. And so and he gave away all kinds of stuff that he shouldn't be giving away. And anyway, so the people of the country became upset and told the king, this can't continue anymore. You're going to have to exile your son. So the king dutifully exiled his son with his wife and two children. And they wandered off to the edge, you know, beyond the boundaries of the kingdom, with just no possessions really, and wandered into some forest, jungle someplace, where they found a clearing. And there they built a hut to live in and set up a life in the jungle. Now, there was apparently a man who, local kind of Brahmanical priest, who was apparently not a very nice guy. And he heard about the Visantara living in the forest, and heard that if you asked him for something, he would give you anything at all, because his fault of generosity, he always gives whatever people asked. And so this man came to Visantara and asked for his children. So he gave his children away. And then he asked for his wife. So he gave his wife away. So what I've told, because it's such an important story in Southeast Asia and Thailand like this, they tell it in popular, it's a very long story, it's like an epic story. And they tell it in oral tradition, still to this day in Thailand, where in the evening or in the monasteries, a storyteller will tell this story and people gather around to listen to it. And at this point, even though people heard the story before, at this point in the story, people start crying. So, you know, it isn't like people say, great, you look at that. But, you know, it's kind of a certain kind of tragedy involved here, giving away your children and your wife. So that's kind of like the important part of the story. But what goes on is that, I feel a little bit odd, but I think a little bit kind of fairy tale-like, but there's this Brahma, this great god Brahma is up in his, heavens, is watching all this and is so moved by how generous Visantara is that he thinks this is really virtuous and wonderful. So he comes down to earth and he writes everything up, gets the children and the wife back, and lets them go back to his home kingdom, and he becomes king and everybody lives happily ever after. So that's very nice, right? It was kind of, and then he dies, and then he gets reborn to be Gautama, and he becomes then the Buddha that we know. And the usual interpretation of this is that the Buddha had to practice generosity, to perfection, perfect generosity before he could become a Buddha. But that doesn't cut it for me. You know, that's supposed to be an example of perfecting generosity, giving away, everything, including your children and your wife. So my reading of this story, my interpretation of it, is that before someone can become a Buddha, to have the level of compassion needed to become a Buddha, they have to make a really big mistake. And he made this huge mistake giving those away. You don't do that. You don't give away people, especially children and your children. He made a huge mistake, he made this big mistake, something different can happen in the heart. There's a humility that happens. It gives born to a certain kind of compassion because you know the depth of pain, the depth of hurt, the depth of disappointment, in a way that you understand other people and what's possible in other people as well. One of the hallmarks of compassion in Buddhism is that compassion, the movement of compassion, feeling compassion, is we feel ourselves as equal to others in their suffering. in, at least in Buddhism, we say that pity is where you feel superior to others. You feel pity for them, you have a sympathy looking down at them, a poor person. Whereas in for compassion, it's like the with passion, sharing with someone is equals. You don't hold yourself apart or above or special, but you feel like somehow you're in it together, like this is the human condition, you know, that you're suffering now. At some point I might have the same suffering, same challenges. So that's my interpretation of that story, that the Buddha had to make a big mistake. And I think that's one of the conditions that can give birth to compassion in a human heart, the capacity for compassion, is to understand this part of our human life, take it in, be honest about it, and then let that transform you and change you. One of the virtues that Buddhism emphasizes is the virtue of being teachable. Are you all teachable? And so the idea that that you're willing to hear something and take in something and be changed by it. So when you make a mistake, are you teachable? Can you learn from that? The Buddhist approach to making mistakes is to be forward-looking, not backward-looking. In the sense that to really own up to the fact that we've done something, make a mistake, done something wrong, something unethical, whatever it might be, hurt someone. But not to wallow in guilt and self-criticism, which is considered backward-looking. But rather be forward-looking, where we think, yes, I did that. That happened. I feel bad about it. Now, how can I do better in the future? What can I learn from this? And one of the things we can learn, I believe, is to see each other much more as fellow human beings, as equals, where we share the depth of feeling, of heart, being challenged in this life of ours. So to sit upright and be still, we sit with all of it. We sit with our successes, our failures, our mistakes, you know, the whole thing. And we allow it to shape us or influence us or open us up. Allow for a deeper sensitivity to happen within our encounters with other people and with ourselves. And that can allow for compassion to arise. Or to say it differently, how can you take in, own up to, the fact that you've caused harm, maybe, done something unethical or hurt someone or made a mistake? How can you own up to it in such a way that it gives birth to a greater caring, greater kindness, greater goodwill, greater compassion, as opposed to taking it in and letting it squash you or diminish you or discourage you or depress you, or taking it in a little bit and then pushing it away or denying it or assigning blame somewhere else? How to sit with it all in the middle of it? So the last thing I want to say, this idea of sitting still and empty, or sitting still, just allowing what's there to be there, just registering and feeling it, being a gracious host for it, is different than saying different than saying you're supposed to sit here and accept yourself as being perfect. That somehow I get kind of a good news kind of Buddhism, good news spiritual, you know, you're innately beautiful and wonderful, you know, and let's just kind of have a wonderful celebratory teaching here about how, you know, we have this beautiful, innate, pure heart, and let's, you know. And it's also not the opposite. What it is, what we're offering here, is not a view or philosophy about what human nature is so much as learning how to be a host for what is here, learning how to meet what is here, to be present and stay present for what is here. And if there's something that at least I trust, it's that if you stay present for experience in an honest and clear way, that it'll work itself out. There's a process of healing, it's a process of clarity, clarification. To become present and be honest about what is allows the heart to be shaped in a way that it can respond most effectively and most compassionately to the world around us. If we don't allow ourselves to take it all in, then if we can't be a host to ourselves, how can we be a host to the world? So if it does happen to some of you, that once upon a time, distant future, you should make a mistake, perhaps you'll approach your mistake in a new way. And perhaps you can let it, in your struggles with it, in the heaviness of it or whatever, that you can allow it to open your heart in a deeper way, fuller way. And perhaps you'll be the next Buddha. So we have a little bit of time. If some of you would like to ask some questions or comments about that. So Linda, Carla would like to ask.
The idea of meeting yourself reminded me of a story that you told that I've been struggling to remember. And I wonder if you could relate the two. It's the young woman who wanted to marry a man, and her father prohibited it, and they ran away. But when he came back, she was still there. Do you remember what I mean?
Should I tell a story?
Yeah, can you relate the two? Because this one's been on my mind for 2 weeks, and I haven't been able to, like, grab it.
What was her name? What? Juso? There's this woman in this Chinese village. These two children grew up together, and maybe neighbors, and boy and a girl. And when they were young teens, I guess they, at some point, they were in love and promised to marry each other. It turned out the father of the girl had other ideas, and so she wanted to marry her to some other person in the village. So they were kind of crushed by this, and so before the marriage was going to happen, the young man who, her friend, he just ran away. And as he was taking the boat up the river, away from the village, he heard someone yelling his name from the shore. So he pulled the boat over, and he found it was the young woman who said, "I'm coming with you." And so they went up and eloped, and lived for a number of years and upriver in some place, and had children. And at some point, the young woman said, "Maybe by now that we have children, something, maybe my father will forgive us for not following his wish. I didn't follow his wishes and marry the other person in the village, but eloped with you." And so they went back, took a boat downriver. And the young man said, "Why don't you stay here? I'll go talk to your father first." So he went and talked to his father. They went and knocked on the door, and the father said, "Oh, there you are. You ran away many years ago. We always wondered what happened to you." And so then he was a little bit surprised to be treated like that, because he assumed everybody realized that the two of them had escaped the same night, so they thought they'd gone off together, right? And he said, "Oh, I came here to, we've come back to, to ask your forgiveness and see if you'll have us back. Your daughter and I," and she's down by the boat still. And the father said, "I don't know what you're talking about. Because the night you ran away, they disappeared, my daughter became sick and has been laying in bed ever since." And the young man that's confused, "What do you mean your daughter's in bed all the time? She's been with me for the last few years." And so at some point they're standing guys discussing this, and then the wife from down by the river comes walking up the road back to the house. And at that point, the woman who's in bed, the daughter that's in the bed, been sick all these years, gets out of bed and walks out of the house and walks down the road And as these two women meet each other on the road, they merge and become one. And so the koan, the question is, which one is the true daughter? The one that went off eloped and ran off with her lover, or the one who stayed home with her father but became sick? Which one's the real one? And what happens when the two, you know, what does it take for the two to meet? So that's the story. So why was that important for you?
Well, you have a image of the meeting of the two that's like the image that I have of sitting still and empty and then meeting myself. You made some articulate points about the meeting of the two the last time you told the story, and I was trying to relate that.
Yeah, I don't know what I said.
So you can think about that for 2 weeks.
Yes. Wait for the mic.
So I also think about this story. And when you were talking about meeting yourself and making a mistake, I was going to ask you, in Buddhism and in Buddhist psychology, what is the importance of restitution?
That's interesting. Restitution. That's not in my working vocabulary, that word. Could you define it or offer a different word?
Well, I guess in this story of the young woman who elopes, part of what allows her to have her reunited life is to come back and somehow make it right.
So make amends.
Make amends with her father or reunite in that relationship. And then she can reunite with herself. So I'm wondering, as we sit and look or face or meet our mistakes in meditation, is there a next step that needs to be taken?
Well, it depends on the circumstances, but there's definitely times where once we've met ourselves. I mean, there are times when people sit and meditate and they realize something they never realized before. Wow, I had no idea that I did that, that happened, and they realize, I can't sit there anymore. I need to go and apologize. I need to go and make amends. I've known people who've left retreat because, they realized something, and, they had a realization experience about some behavior that they had in the past, and now I have to go. It doesn't make any sense to keep sitting here until I go and take care of this. I remember John Travis, the teacher, tells a story of sitting in India, and it's being stuck. And then he went to see a teacher, and the teacher said, you have to go back to America and see your father. And so he went and he was a hippie sadhu in India, and he went and got a suit made to meet his father in his father's terms, and went back to Kentucky. And the teacher also said, when you go back and see your father, but don't stay long. So he went, got a suit, went to Kentucky, saw his father, and then went back to India. That's a long trip from India to, just... So yeah, definitely there are times when something has to happen. Apologies, amends, restitutions, I guess, something done. Yes?
So the characters' names were Sujay and Anjay. And your answer to who the real Sujay was the one who was greeting the other. Does this ring a bell?
No, but I wonder if that's someone. I wonder if someone else gave the story here. And you didn't. Because I don't think I would have said Sujay and Anjay, but I wonder if we had a Zen teacher visiting.
It was the other Gil.
The other Gil, yeah.
It was the other Gil. I actually have written Gil's answer.
Well, it's a great answer. I like the answer, the one who...
There was more.
Oh, there's more.
Shall I?
I'm not sure. Go ahead.
That the one who was the Sujay who was lying in bed was representing the one who grieves, was meeting the one who had realized her desire to be with her lover and went away, mm-hmm. and so that the real one was the one that was meeting it. And the Gil, the other Gil who was here that day, said that the way you would express this in a Zen tradition wouldn't be by explaining it the way, right. But you might do a gesture like reaching your hand out like this, or,
right.
or hugging somebody or something.
You would demonstrate it rather than talk about it.
Yeah.
You'd be it. Be the answer rather than talk the answer. And so it's so easy to become split from oneself. And part of the function of meditation is to heal the split. And, to have this meeting. And sometimes in the meeting, sometimes we're the host, sometimes we're the guest, and sometimes we're both host and guest. And how do we bring those together? And when we bring them together well, completely, then host and guest disappears entirely. Then we just are. Okay. So, you know what to do? So thank you very much, and I hope you have a nice week.